show here. There are additions to the class website, mostly Joe's. I guess the first one that came in is this one here at the bottom that I threw up on Saturday. Where's my mouse? As response to a request from Claire for the code that produced figure 5.34, the figure with the 2.8 coordinates on it. So that's on the website. And then I sent you an email saying I forgot to explain some of the pesky details in that code, including hidden parts of the computer system SRR that we're using. And shame on me, that's really bad pedagogy, not to explain what the very first command in the file is, for instance. Why am I transposing a matrix? So you can copy it, or you can understand it, or best, both. Now, Joe has four more files. Joe.
Those are data files, the bottom three, and the top one is an R exercise.
They're not data files. They're fake files.
Those are files of the most real data I ever deal with,
okay, right,
which is simulated data, and they are for an R exercise, which is in the text of which is in that first file. There is a part of it where you have to come up with a function to apply the contrast procedure to columns of a matrix and assemble that into a matrix. I've left that part to you. So there is a little bit of R programming in there, plus a function that plots the results of the, it plots, I don't want to enrage Fred, but
do you want me to go? Do you want me to go down in this?
Go down a little.
So tell me where to
stop.
A
little further. Okay. So anyway, I give you commands. You can pretty much just do them. But then there are down around seven that you have to do some stuff yourself. And at the bottom is a plot file that will plot you pictures of the fishes. These are imaginary fishes, and I've had you get the eigenvalues of the covariance matrix and get the first eigenvector, and it will plot that. Fred will be telling us why that's meaningless. I will be telling you that it's not so meaningless, and with a little bit of work you can get us fighting with each other on this subject.
Well, I was going to do that about a half hour from now.
Okay, that's fine. And this is for the lecture I give when I come back in town.
Yeah.
So it will be a week from Thursday.
Modifications of the schedule, if you remember. Neither one of us is here Thursday. I'm in London, Joe is Mexico?
Mexico.
A ways apart, probably not on the internet.
And we might pass through the airport at the same time.
It's tomorrow night?
No, tomorrow morning.
Yeah. So you are supposed to talk among yourselves, elect a monitor and so on. Tuesday, a week from today, we're still not back, but Paul Sampson, a colleague of mine from statistics, who Joe knows well, is coming here, and I will be telling him how far we got in Chapter 4. He has a copy of the book also, and he will talk about whatever he wants, but he knows multivariate analysis even better than I do, even though at one point he was my graduate student, but since then the roles have somewhat reversed. So not that I'm his graduate student, but he's been doing this here for 35 years, whereas I've been doing philosophy and biology. So he is a completely different kind of blackboard against which to silhouette your questions about computing and biology. A week from Thursday, we're back.
Then I'm back, yeah.
I'm back in the evening, but that's a little... That doesn't
oh, that day. Okay,
class.
So you just missed that
yeah.
day. For the discussion here, I think it might be good if somebody volunteered to be discussion leader or, you know, just mostly just to prevent it from breaking up into small sub-discussions or
just
like
dissolve
that. Anybody want to volunteer to lead the discussion? And part of it will be judging when you don't have anything left to discuss and you can all leave the room, basically.
I would suggest that whoever's doing that do what we do and stop in a half hour before at the department office to get the projector so that you can at least bring up things from the class website. on the board so people are looking all at the same view at the same time.
Yeah, that's in the biology study area, 220 mm-hmm. here, and we'll try to leave them with an email saying that that's what.
Yeah, that there's.
Both for this and for Paul.
For Paul, right.
Yeah. Any volunteers to be a dictator of the discussion? Okay. Cooper? Everybody doesn't object to this?
Yes.
Unanimous consent.
Okay.
Boy, is this not a matter.
And, you know, that can just include saying what on earth did they mean by this and what on earth did they mean by that. Okay.
Any other organizational matters? I was over here. I am still over there. Catalyst and the internet. No. Okay. Then this is another one of my experimental teaching lectures. I've taught from chapter 4 only fragmentarily in Vienna. A lot of my colleagues here have looked at it and have not given me back any comments. I got comments back from a genomicist in London, Clive Bowman, that he's not a professor. So I've set this up on the schedule for 2 days today, and then I guess it's 2 weeks from today. And rather than rush, I would gladly just slip schedule. Before we do this, I'd like to show, wrong screen, three. We were talking last Thursday, about two-point shape coordinates like this, and I sent you out a copy of my own command file for this figure. This is 5.34. This is the one that Claire was asking me about. But what I didn't do then was actually show you the direction in which we're going, which is this picture for the same comparison. That's near the end of chapter 5. This is the thin... I got the wrong picture. This is the thin plate spline for that picture. And this is the same spline multiplied by 2. The reason I'm putting these up is we were talking about this in the context of uniform transformations, single triangles, like a big triangle here from Bregma to Inion and down to Prostheon. And I said, this is large scale, but it's not uniform. At least I hope that's what I said, because that's what's true. At the end of the posting on the website for that example, there's the code you haven't seen yet that says this transformation is about 1/4 uniform and 2/4 very large scale. And what that 2/4 is kind of obvious from here. The brain case is relatively smaller and the jaw is relatively larger. Remember, the brain is back here and the jaw now is facing down. And that's an important part of the verbal description after you turn off your computer and start talking to your colleagues again. So this is a system by which you can produce transformations that could be uniform, in which case this is a self-describing picture, or might not be uniform, in which case you have to go further. And the tools for deciding about this are on their way. They're in Chapter 5. We just haven't talked about them yet. The example that we had for the rat-growing skull between 7 and 14 was, I think, 90% uniform. This example isn't. And we needed this to get to the end of the story.
Why did you need to go?
Oh, because if I don't multiply by 2, it's harder to read.
Just for the eye.
Yeah, if it's we're using a property of the human retina that we certainly didn't evolve for, and you can kind of see that this is a little smaller and this is kind of stretched, but it's a whole lot easier to see it if I just double it. And there are rules, some of which are actually stated in the book, for where you stop doing this. You stop doing this after the grid starts to collapse on itself, where if something goes to zero or folds, you're gone too far. But where it folds is also information, and we've got, so there's the description of that coming somewhere. The numbers that we're using, give me just a second to bring that up. Yeah.
So the thing that's posted on the web is this. Now the stuff I was just talking about, those extra numbers are down here at the end using code you haven't seen yet. It's this line of numbers where 0.26 is the fraction that's uniform.
You might make that bigger.
I can't, actually. I don't know how.
Oh,
so
maybe if you click in the upper left corner.
Upper left. There's nothing. This is Linux.
Click on the little picture. Will that?
Click on that, maybe. That's a good guess. Let's try it. Let's try full screen. Oh, no.
Well,
that won't help.
Hit escape.
Okay.
That
still won't help.
If you hit escape, I think it'll go back.
Well, that's what I was hitting.
Uh-oh. Now I really caused you trouble.
You clobbered me.
You could control
V. Let's try exit. Let's just get out of here. There we go. Yeah. Okay, where was I? It doesn't matter. There was a list of numbers, one of which was the fraction of the transformation's variance that's uniform. And that number was 26% here. And for the rat growth example, 7 to 14, it was 90%. So you get these tools later, but not too much later, they're in Chapter 5, to make sense of this question of how to talk about things. No more hints about screen management today, Joe, okay?
Okay, I'm chasing.
We don't know Linux. All right, so roughly here, and I want to start with something that will look like a digression, but it isn't. I don't need to... first the text. What we did in that first absolutely crash course, the first two lectures, was everything you should have had in the previous course about predicting a single variable, least squares prediction of things. And so it's sort of obvious to say those approaches are centering on one particular measurement, the one that you're trying to predict. There is a more general way of talking about multiple measures, which is the statisticians call multivariate analysis. It is actually more central to the social sciences than to the biological sciences, because the social sciences usually aren't reductionist. They don't have ways of explaining phenomena in terms of lower level stuff. They don't have genes, for instance. And here in biology, we try to drive down to levels of actual control. But you can't always do that. Sometimes all you have is a bunch of length measures without any of the hormones, without any of the genes. And for that, there are statistics that have been adapted mostly in the middle of the 20th century under the general name multivariate biometrics. And what I do is multivariate morphometrics, specializing in the geometric kind of data. And what Joe does is multivariate biometrics, specializing in phylogenetic contrasts and things like that, and genomic components. So this corresponds to a change in the way you think about statistics that actually matches very nicely what's going on with genomics, where you're just getting much more reticulate data representations for the same price. What it doesn't yet change is the way the statistician is trying to teach you how to think about this. And the hint I gave you a little while ago about the disagreement between Joe and me is I will continue to think like a statistician about reasons to believe in something. That's a function of data. And I emphasize that. It's not that you disagree with having a reason, but you don't emphasize it in your own work. I do data analysis.
I just do less thinking than you do.
No, I'm just more cynical than you are about God's maliciousness in guiding us through measurements of the world. There's a quote from Einstein that God is subtle, but he's not malicious. The God of data is often malicious. Probably God with a small g. So here's a formula that we went past very fast in Chapter 3. It's the sort of thing you get in a second course in biometry. It's the sampling error of a correlation.
So some of the stuff we'll be talking about, we've been talking about, is correlations. And this is a statistician talking. So there's always a sampling error of your correlation, this thing we write with a sigma. Yeah, it's right there. And the fact that this is in chapter 4 and the formula starts with a 3 means it was the subject of text that you didn't get. So two questions arise automatically. First, what else is there on this list besides the sampling error of a correlation? What should you be thinking about at the same time? And second, how do you handle sampling errors of correlations? What do you do with them? I will continue to assume this is real data we're talking about, so you have questions like, are these two correlations the same? Is one of them bigger than the other? Do they have opposite sign? And the answer to that question is a subtle one. So if you're following this along in the text, you kind of turn the page, and you get to this pair of figures on page 4, which is better if you blow it up. So it's over here. No, wrong page. It's over here. Still wrong page. Where are those figures? There they are. Okay. So there's something here at the left and something here at the right, and you probably haven't seen either one of these before. But these are how statisticians have been thinking about questions like the one I just raised. How do you think about a correlation and the uncertainty of a correlation? Statisticians have been thinking about this for about 100 years. A little bit more if you're Carl Pearson, a little bit less if you're Don Wisher. So the first part of the answer is, you have to think about more than the correlation that's on your mind or on your plate or on your screen. You have to think about everything about the data set at the same time. If you have a correlation, you must have at least two variables. So let's zoom our camera down to just two variables for now so I can draw the picture. And if you've got two variables, you've got two means, two averages, which I'm not going to talk about because we talked about that a lot back in chapter two. And then you have two variances and a covariance. And you got the correlation by dividing the covariance by the square root of the product of the variances. So that's five quantities. Two means and these three numbers, two variances and a covariance. And the statistician says, you really need to be thinking in terms of five quantities. Let's forget the means for the moment and just talk about those variances and the covariance. And so we're in a system that has three axes. This is figure 4.1 left. The first axis here is the variance of the first variable. And I'm drawing it here just by lengthening the horizontal of this covariance ellipse picture. The second axis is vertical. It's the variance of the second variable. And the third axis, which has to be into the page, because this is paper or a screen, is the correlation between the variables. And the number you're asking about, as a biologist, the correlation, is one of three that all go together at the same time, because they're sampled at the same time. And we'll get to that formula, a fairly complicated looking one you don't have to know, but your computer knows it, in a minute. So all these three things are going to be covariating. The variance of the first variable, the variance of the second variable, the correlation between them. And the reason this is important is, unless your variables are perfectly uncorrelated, sampling error in one of these is going to be correlated with the sampling error in the others. If you have two correlated variables, then being wrong about the mean of the first one means you're going to be wrong about the mean of the second one, because they're correlated. And this is the statistician talking. You, the biologist, want to talk about just one number. The statistician is going to insist, until you plug your ears and say, la, 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 I can't hear you, that you keep in mind that this is a multivariate distribution. I could have said this in 1900 and it would be meaningless, but in 1928, John Wishart came up with the formulas for this full multivariate distribution. And now that we have the formulas, there's no excuse for denying that they exist. You don't have to master them, but there are approximations all over the place. And that formula with the standard error of the correlation is one of those approximations. Fisher was very fond of it. It was actually 15 years before him. So here's the number you thought you were talking about, and it's one out of three axes. Over here is what a sampling distribution looks like for two of those three measures at the same time. This looks like we're cutting through the middle of a sphere, and we are cutting through the middle of a sphere because I'm sampling around totally uncorrelated variables of the same variance. Those don't exist in biology. They only exist in statistics textbooks. So this is a sampling distribution in which I've showed you that there's some uncertainty, even given a zero correlation, there's some uncertainty of the standard error sigma x, that's this way, and some uncertainty of the correlation. And those two measures are uncorrelated if the original variables were uncorrelated. And otherwise, there's a formula coming that I'll show you in just a minute. So based on your assumptions about what the world looks like, you get different instructions for how to handle what you thought was a really simple question. What's the uncertainty of this correlation? The uncertainty of this correlation is a function of every other uncertainty you might have. The uncertainty of the standard errors, the uncertainty of the means, it's a function of everything. Okay. So I'm saying this is a picture you haven't seen before because it's the scatter of the relationship between two statistics. It's not your data. Well, it is your data. It's based on your data, not here. This is a simulation. But it's how these things get started. So now, let's go back to the formula for the correlation, and we go to a hideous page of text, page 8, that explains where you find that variance. And you find it in a paper by Carl Pearson, published in 1898. This is not something you do by hand. It is, amazingly enough, something he did by hand. But he was a great statistician. He was the first great statistician. He could do this by hand. Up here is another matrix that actually comes from the likelihood formulation that we've mentioned a little, and I'll be showing a little bit more. This is a matrix of what's called information. And the crucial concept that the statistician brings to this is whatever your data sample, as long as it is real data, and again, Joe and I are on opposite sides of the table here, as long as this is real data, it brings to you an accompanying matrix of information about the parameters in your statistical model, whatever they are. So in this case, your statistical model is a Bell surface, a bivariate Gaussian, a pair of correlated variables, and the three parameters are the ones I was just showing you, axis 1, axis 2, axis 3, two variances and a correlation for now. And this is the matrix the statistician gives you for the second derivatives of the likelihood at the optimal. And this is the matrix that's converted into. And this is the formula, if you divide by an M, sample size, this is the formula for that sampling error. So it comes from an analysis of the model. In this case, it's e to the minus x squared plus y squared over 2 times some stuff. But this is the variance of the third parameter, the correlation. And this is the variance of the first parameter here, the standard error of x. And it's sigma x squared over 2. So the standard error of the standard error is the variance of x divided by 2m. That's interesting. You didn't know it before. This is a new formula from 1898, which is, I mean, Mozart had already been dead for 100 years. This is modern, and it's an elementary formula, and it was new in my grandfather's lifetime. Here's the standard error of the next parameter, the sigma y. This is the standard error of the correlation once you divide by n. As I mentioned, we're going to do some manipulation with that in a minute. These are the correlations of the parameters. They're correlated sampling errors. The correlation between your estimate of the standard error of the first one and the standard error of the second one is the product of those standard errors divided by 2 times r squared. So if the correlation really is 0, that correlation between the estimates is 0. And if the correlation really is 0.8, then your estimates of the standard error are correlated. And you'd better not just have a table that says length of leg mean standard deviation, length of arm mean standard deviation, because if leg length and arm length are correlated, then their standard deviation estimates are correlated. And you have to say so if you want to be honest. So the standard form of the biometric table is missing this already, because it comes from a pre-multivariate date. And here, continuing, this is the correlation between that first standard error and the correlation coefficient, which is this column. So the correlation, the sampling error of the relation between that and that, between the first and the third axis, is this rather odd-looking formula, which has a standard deviation of x in it and has a correlation in it. In fact, it has the correlation cubed in it, which you probably wouldn't expect to find. And whatever your model, a matrix like this always exists. Usually it doesn't have letters in it. Usually it just has numbers in it for the maximum likelihood estimates. But it is always there. It's called the information matrix, and it is how every single competent statistician answers questions like the one we started with. What's the sampling error of, and the answer, the question doesn't end, what's the sampling error of this parameter? The question is, what is the sampling error of my estimated model parameters, plural? What's the sampling error of all of them together? And sometimes they're uncorrelated and sometimes they're not. There's some text that I've skipped over because this was actually more important that indicates simple examples of this. We started with the standard error of a mean back in chapter 2. You remember that high school algebra example, sigma divided by square root of n? That's a special case of this. If your model only has one parameter in it, an average, and if your data is multivariate normal, then if you run this machinery, you get the formula you already have. The standard error of the mean is the standard error of the data divided by square root of n. And you get lots of other things too. But you need the rest of this to do correlations and principal components and contrasts and all the rest of this. I'm going to throw something at you now. This really is an experiment to remind you of what the difference between Joe and me really is. Here's a picture you saw before. It's basically from a data analysis of Pearson's, except he didn't use computers, but this is his data. It's mother's height against daughter's height, if you remember it. It's from somewhere in chapter 2. This is one of the regression lines. I guess that's daughter on mother. This is mother on daughter. And these dots are the verification that this is a multivariate, bivariate normal model. And this is Pearson's figure. The model and its verification. You can't do this from simulations, of course. When you have a simulation, the model is always true. So you expect the verification to work. But this is real data. And Pearson's saying these points, these class means, lie really close to those regression lines. So the regression model is very likely to be true. That's a theorem.
So what those are is each one is the mean of a vertical slice.
This is the mean of all of the dots above and below it. This is the mean of those. This is the mean of all of the dots to the left and right of it, left and right, and so on. And Pearson guessed at a theorem that actually wasn't proven until 1949, that if both of these are close enough to lines, if they're on lines within sampling error, the data has to be multivariate Gaussian. So if those dots are close enough to straight lines, the Gaussian model has to be true, or at least is supported by everything in the data analysis. And that means then that you can use the machinery I was just showing you about correlations and so on. But you need that picture to infer anything from your arithmetic, because the correlation, of course, is a parameter of a model that looks like this. And if your data doesn't look like this, you don't have any way to start. Now, I'm talking data. And as Joe repeats, and we've agreed on this for years, he works much more with simulations in which this question doesn't arise unless there's a coding error. The simulation is always true, matching the model. And what you want to ask about is how the parameters, uncertainties change as you bend the assumptions or change the sample size. That isn't the question here. It isn't actually the question for the rest of this book. The question for the rest of this book is what's happening in the data? And how do you talk about it? So, assuming that something like this has been verified, here's a formula that actually gives you instructions about what to do. And here's the problem. This is now a simulation, but it's a simulation of multivariate, of bivariate normal data. And here's a sample correlated 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, and sample size is 2,000. Here's the histogram of the correlation, and these are not the same distribution. The distribution of the correlation is a function of the true correlation, which makes it hard for the biologist who wants to say something about two of these, like somebody else's paper and my paper. So this is saying the standard error of the correlation is going to go as 1 minus it squared. So the standard error of this is 1 minus 0.81, so it's 0.19 square root of. No, 0.19 standard error. And this has a 0.99 standard error. So these are different. But we have a formula that comes from the likelihood machinery. And I'm going to wave some high school algebra at you. I'm going to take that formula, take its reciprocal. This is just something statisticians do. Write it out in partial fractions. You had this in high school, at least I did. Notice that that thing is the derivative of this thing. And then you remember from statistics that the variance of the function of something is the variance of the something times the square of the derivative of the function. Don't remember that, but if you were a statistician, it would be on the exam. So if noticing this thing, this bit about the formula, this is what Fisher actually did. He did this in his head, of course. I say, of course, because he was Ronald Fisher. He's a lot smarter than me. I had to type it. He noticed that that was the reciprocal of the derivative of this, and this means that there's a variance stabilizing transformation. If you convert the correlation by that formula, its variance is a constant, regardless of its true value. And this is the same set of simulations now, where instead of giving you the R from the simulation, I'm giving you the Z from the simulation, that Fisher Z, 1/2 the log of 1 plus R over 1 minus R. And those are now all the same distribution, meaning we know how to compare them. It's basically, is this plus it plus two standard deviations overlapping enough with this minus two standard deviations? You compare these by T ratios. Or you say, what's the plus or minus around this? What's the plus or minus around this? Do they overlap? So from this formula, which came from that weird matrix computation, this is not an intuitive formula, but what it gives you is the intuitive rule for talking about correlations. And you needed the statistician in the room, but now he can leave the room. This is the authority of formulas to simplify your life. And it is fundamentally the reasons that we urge you, Joe and I both, to go into the algebra or the calculus of this as far as you can until you become as comfortable as you can with the formulas you have to use. We'll be getting, probably not till my next lecture, into what a principal component is, and there'll be some formulas about principal components. Try to understand how those formulas come from stuff like the matrix theorem, the information matrix, because the statistician will want you to do that, will want you to at least be using the right formulas, which doesn't go without saying. And if you're asking a more interesting question like, are these the same covariance structure? You'll want to know why the formula that's the log of the product of the eigenvalues divided by the sum of the eigenvalues, you'll want to know why that formula is the correct number for answering that question. Because somebody might ask you, why are you using the geometric, the log of the arithmetic geometric mean ratio? Why are you using that? The answer is because that captures the likelihood ratio between the two hypotheses you're asking me about. The first one is the same covariance structure. The second one is different covariance structures. And if that's your question, there's a number that answers it. And the statisticians told us that number about 1950, and that's the number we use after you check the multivariate Gaussian hypotheses, after you check that you've got a normal distribution. So some of this is the comfort of a constraint that you don't really have a choice about the formulas. If the statistician says, for your question, there's one specific best answer under the assumption of multivariate Gaussian normality, that's the answer you have to use, with that very important footnote that that assumption needs to be checked by pictures like the ones that I was just showing you from Pearson, by showing that the regressions are fairly strong and pretty linear in both directions, not just the one you're asking about. But this is pretty simple algebra. You need to know why you're doing it. I mean, once you have this formula, this is called Fisher's Z, and it's printed out by the computer. So if any of you have run a linear model or run a correlation test, in most packages, SPSS certainly, they print this. Because somewhere in the room there might be a statistician. And the reason they print it is that it solves the problem of how to normalize the correlation, which isn't anything you thought you cared about. But it is if you're asking questions about the numbers. Okay, back here. Still on page 8, 9, 10. Okay, that's the first point here. And there's a lot more text if you care about it. Oh, here's the data example from Pearson's data set. Here are the two matrices. From the data I just showed you, here are the numbers you get. And this oddly looks simulated, but it's not. The correlation really is 0.50 for this data. So when I write down something that looks like a number on a ruler, this looks like 1/32nd in decimal notation. It really is a half of 1/4 squared. This is the right number from the matrix. This is not a simulation. This is data. All I did was change to 1,000 cases from 1,300 to make it come out looking good. So if that was your data, height of a daughter, height of a mother, if the correlation really was 0.5, then these are what the text says here on page, wherever we are, page 9. These are the standard errors you want to know. This is the standard error of the correlation after dividing by 1,000. This is the standard error of the variance of the mother's height. This is the standard error of the variance of the daughter's height. This is going to be the correlation of those estimated variances. And this is the correlation of either one with the correlation. Once you check the assumptions, which we just did for that data set. Okay. That's the first philosophical point. And there's one, at least one more coming. One more coming, then we're kind of done with this section. And we'll, there are three sections in the chapter, and it's scheduled for two lectures, so I should get somewhere into the second section. Looks like I might. So we're halfway through the first section here. And this is the next philosophical point, that as soon as you start thinking about multivariate analysis, about multiple measurements, even if you've only got two measures, either mother's height and daughter's height, or arm length and leg length, you still get to ask, what other measurements might you have taken? This is ironic, because the field that started asking that question is psychology. They started asking it way earlier than we did. At the time of invention of the IQ test, about 1900, people started asking about item analysis. What if you'd ask different questions? Or spelling tests in school, test theory generally. For us, the mother's height, daughter's height question is, who else's height might you want to measure? And that actually came from a data set in which Pearson also measured father's height and son's height. And in fact, if there were two sons, he measured both sons' height. If there were two daughters, he measured both daughters' height. So it's a six-person data set. And he also measured arm length and leg length and arm span and a couple of other things, which is the other question. If you measured these two lengths, why those two lengths? Why not lots of other lengths? Why not circumferences? Why not areas? And multivariate analysis, in our context, always has to keep those questions in the background. Why did you measure what's in the paper and then stop? What else might you have measured? For geometric morphometrics, those studies of the points, like Joe's simulated fish or my real skulls and rat things, the question is, can you at least talk about everything you might have measured on those points? And the answer is yes. Given that set of points, there is a complete multivariate method of anything you might have measured in the form of distances and angles and proportions. And that's what we're going to be teaching in section 5.4. It's Procrustes' multivariate analysis. But that's still begging the question of why those points? Why not these curves? Why a two-dimensional slice instead of a three-dimensional organism? There's no best answer to any of that, but you have to keep it in mind. And so BMI won't arise in most of our analyses, that example we had in Chapter 2, because its formula is in units of pressure, and that's not terribly standard. It is good for doing biometrics. What page? Okay, next page. Then there are two main types of things you might compute, and this looks abstract, but it's a very short section. There's only another half a page coming. You might be looking for a profile, meaning you have a question in advance, and you're looking for a list of numbers. I've already showed you one of those today. We had the example for Claire of the young versus the old shape coordinates, two-point shape coordinates, and I gave you a list of 20 numbers for fractions of variance on the 20 partial warps, and then said, look, the first three are bigger than the other 17. That's a profile question, because the question of telling the difference between the babies and the grown skulls was there before. An explanatory task set in advance. Or else, number two is an extremum. Here's an entire family of possible descriptors. I want the best one. We've also mentioned this already today. The first principal component, whatever it is, whatever my other objections to it, is an extremal descriptor. It's the linear combination of your measured variables, whatever they are, that has the largest variance for a fixed sum of squares of coefficients. That's its definition. saying it, it makes sense to ask, why are you asking about this? Does it make any biological sense to say fixed sum of squares of coefficients? My answer is no. Joe's answer is maybe. It might be the same answer in particular examples. But in any case, this is a question about the best description from some family. And this is a question about a particular description that comes as a bunch of numbers. Profile. The analogy is you look out your window at the Olympics from your apartment, and it looks like that. It's your profile. It goes up and down, up and down, up and down. And you're interested in the up part and the down part. Whereas for a principal component, the interest is not particularly in the ups and downs. The interest is in how much of the information is encoded in that pattern versus the next pattern or all of the other patterns. And either of these approaches you might do once and then say, I don't care about the rest, it's treated as noise, I'm not interested. Or you might do it more than once. You might pull out a pattern, look at what's left, pull out another pattern, and keep on going. And for both of these kinds of approaches, that happens. For the examples in the rest of the book, GMM is being applied here as information from a set of points. But the multivariate analysis is not, well, it was not developed for sets of points. The multivariate analysis was there basically 60 years before I started working, 40 years before I was born. This is standard 20th century multivariate analysis applied to new biological questions. Some of them are new from the turn of the 20th century, questions about lots of measured lengths, and some of them are new from nearly the turn of the 21st century, all of the information in this picture. We were talking there about matrices, those patterns of that information matrix is a matrix, and what's most important here from the rest of multivariate analysis is there are two fundamentally different ways of thinking about a matrix. One is inversion, and one is eigenanalysis. Not only are they different, but their history is different. The word eigenanalysis is German. That should give you a hint that this comes from some other part of the world. Inversion is what we've already talked about in doing multiple regression. But it's much more important, it seems to me, to think of them as essentially different than similar in any way, even though there are some pictures that relate to them. So if you jump ahead to page 15, the picture on page 15 says, here's how you can interpret matrix inversion as a kind of, here's a picture of a matrix inverse, here's a picture of an eigenanalysis, and here's a picture of a matrix inverse in terms of an eigenanalysis. The mathematician loves this. The biologist finds this absolutely irrelevant, that the mathematics of these is similar, because their applications are totally different. In matrix inversion, you are trying to find combinations of variables that are only correlated with one of the originals at a time. So let me jump back here to page 13, where you've got this as bulleted text. And again, this has nothing to do with morphometrics per se. This is true whenever you're using a matrix inverse. When we were doing linear regression, a regression formula, you remember Sewell Wright, was giving you a path coefficient for every predictor. That was the effect of changing that predictor, leaving all of the others alone. That's the important logic here, that it makes sense to change that predictor, leaving all the others alone. That this is something about that particular predictor by itself. And following that language, you can actually sort of derive the formula for matrix analysis, for matrix inverse analysis. It's here at the footnote. If you want to know how just saying that gets you to the formula for matrix inverses, it's here on the footnote on page 17. which I stole from a textbook from a great statistician, David Cox, and forgot to say I got it from him. So this is a matrix inverse, if you haven't seen this before, never mind, and I'm interpreting it as instructions about thinking about variables, one at a time, because this says this particular line of the inverse is correlated with the first variable and not any of the others. This second line of the inverse matrix is correlated with the second variable and not any of the others, etc. So you use a matrix inverse in this logical sense if your variables make sense as individual variables. Length and color, weight and strength, even if they're correlated, essentially different kinds of things. Length of arm and length of leg aren't like that, usually. They might be if you're studying a fossorial organism, a digging organism, when you either dig with your front feet or your back feet, or a running organism when you run with your forelegs or your back legs. But you need models, you need explanatory models to tell you that you're going to be talking about those variables separately. In geometric morphometrics, usually we aren't doing that. Usually we just have some points from the picture that we've got because they're easy to see on the picture, and we don't have particular insights a priori in advance that say some of these points are going to be essentially different from the other points. In geometric morphometrics, usually the points are a sample of convenience of something. Even for Sewell Wright, with his chicken example, we had two skull measures and two arm measures and two leg measures. And he says, I've chosen these because I'm going to be finding genetic components, morphogenetic components of these body compartments. So he could use inverse measures if he wants to. And I think it's in this chapter that I show the method of computing an inverse leads you into some insight into Sewell Wright, that his principal components work harder to get. Excuse me, I gotta take a cough drop here. So, some data sets, especially small data sets, have patterns of variables that were systematically chosen for some underlying theory, but that's not usually the case in morphometrics. What's usually the case is instead the sort of thing that eigenanalysis is trying to do. Eigenanalysis is saying, you didn't actually think very hard about that list of variables you picked, not as a biologist. Maybe you took the points you could see, maybe you took the sculling questions you could answer. Your variables are samples of a universe of possible measures. And eigenanalysis is saying, I don't care about any of your variables separately. I care about the patterns that cover all of them. And so the assumptions for an eigenanalysis are nothing like the assumptions that Sewell Wright taught me to teach you last week, 2 weeks ago, for path analysis. Path analysis says each of these is a real biological process. You can fiddle with one at a time, holding the others constant. Maybe it is a gene and we do the knockout. Maybe it's an injection of a drug. In an eigenanalysis, by comparison, we're talking about looking for patterns, looking for extremal descriptions, and the patterns are being described mostly as arbitrary linear combinations. We had what looked like an arbitrary linear combination when we wrote down a regression formula, but that wasn't an arbitrary linear combination. That was the first path coefficient times the first variable plus the second path coefficient times the second variable, and so on. These formulas instead say the combinations are more real than the variables you picked to reflect them. And that's coming in a sentence here at the bottom of the page. I think that's really kind of important. Sentence I stole from my sociology background.
the things we're computing in an eigenanalysis are linear combinations where the combinations have to mean something regardless of the values of those coefficients, which can be positive or negative. And the negative ones can cause you a lot of trouble. We understood a formula for weighted averaging, for instance, way back in the first lecture, but those weights were all positive. So a negative number has to be interpreted. The lecture for Chapter 3 showed you a negative number for a path coefficient in a multiple regression. It was the negative number for survival as predicted by body length. And we interpreted that as proportion, big leg, small body was good, small leg, big body was bad. So we had to work as biologists to interpret a negative correlation. In this chapter, before we my second lecture on it, we'll do that same data as a multivariate analysis. Instead of looking for the pattern that predicts death, we'll find two patterns, one of which is size, and the other of which, what do you know, predicts death by accident. Predicts death just as well as the one we found in the pattern study. But it has a different algebra. It's now an optimal second dimension of description of the sample, suggesting that it is selectively real because, and Joe will agree with this, stable principal components are likely to be evolutionarily meaningful. But they have to be stable. You have to confirm them. And so this very last, those of you who might be following this, where is it? Is it in this chapter? Yeah, the example I'm talking about here is in figure 4.9 and 4.10. Let me just jump ahead to show you where it's coming. 43, so it's 30 pages from here. We're in the section on principal components. This is the second principal component of the survival data. Here's total length against femoral length. So here's two of the variables we found before from now a pattern analysis, an extremum analysis, an eigenanalysis, a different analysis. The same data. Here's the discrimination we came to two lectures ago, and here's the discrimination from that second principal component, and they are just as good. The agreement between these two methods approaching the same data set is what's important here. It's much better to do the analysis both ways and get the same answer than to do it either way and say, this is the way I was taught to do data analysis. What's ironic as hell about this is that this figure appears nowhere else in the literature of this data set, which is from 1898. No one noticed this before I wrote up this chapter a year ago, that the regression method and the principal component method give you the same answer to Bumpus's question. If this weren't data from 1898, you would kill for a thesis data set like this, data set that teaches something about the methods as well as something about the birds. This is unbelievably lucky that I, who know nothing about birds, stumbled into this as a published data set. Anyway, let's go back 30 pages. Okay, I was giving you some alternate language here. This is language from sociology, which was doing this kind of modeling pretty early as well, that a formative indicator is something that comes from the path analysis rules, Chapter 3, and a reflective indicator has coefficients that are proportional to covariances or correlations. So formative indicators have coefficients that are path coefficients, cause-effect
coefficients.
And reflective indicators are proportional correlations. So, in the formative setting, the indicators cause the construct, their linear combination. You choose how much of this gene to knock out, how much of an injection to give. In the reflective setting, which is eigenanalysis, the construct causes the indicators. You set a value somehow, you, the genome, for body size, and it affects all of the length measures at the same time. Or you set a value for locomotor efficiency, and it affects all aspects of body shape at the same time. Locomotor efficiency as compared to escaping from predators, or hiding, or reproducing, or sexual display. So this is then, we're here at the end of section 4.1.2, and this again is an important point. I'm on the wrong page here. Yeah, the end of 4.1.2, because these are differences in your language as a biologist. Yes, it's different computer programs, multiple regression versus principal component analysis, but mainly it's asking questions in a different way. What's the difference between these groups instead of what's the pattern of these measurements? And when, like in the example of birds I just showed you, and I do urge you to print this chapter, it's on the class website. In the example with the birds, when the two questions end up giving you the same biological answer, that's when you've learned something really important about the world, not just the method. If survival looks like a principal component of size measures, that's probably the bird doing it, not the computer.
Actually, Joe, I've hit you with this for the first time. In between the coughs, do you have any response to that rather radical claim of mine?
About the principal components?
About when they agree, that's when you really get excited?
I think certainly you should be very interested at that point, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm being a little more radical on that. I'm saying if you only get an answer by using one method, it's probably not worth being excited.
But your principal component, I was distracted because I was preparing something for a future class.
Your graduate students did that.
You had taken principal components of shape variation, of measurement variation.
Yeah, these are actually log lengths.
In the total sample.
Right.
Of the log lengths. And you found a principal component.
Mm-hmm. And they found two components, and one of them.
And
separated.
Then you're finding also that fitness seems to be
on one of the components.
It seemed to be following one of those. It strikes me that that is not obvious that that will always happen. So
no.
Yes,
yeah.
It's an interesting fact. I'm not sure that there is some principle in nature that would push you in that direction. The directions in which you vary within a population may or may not be the same as the ones as the variables that fitness depends on. So it's interesting.
It's a new principle. It's saying essentially, if something is as selectively as important as surviving a snowstorm, maybe it should be a factor, not just a. This is the argument against Landy. Landy says, take GP inverse or PG inverse, whichever it is, just do a matrix inversion to get your selection vectors, and I'm saying no. If this is going to be evolutionary biology, it's probably an eigenanalysis, not a matrix inversion. Landy, you got the wrong formula from the get-go. And, of course, he won't listen to me. He's a full professor at Oxford. What do I know?
He's not at Oxford, but anyway, he's in Imperial College London, right. About to move to Norway. So.
Oh, okay. Well, I have the, anyway, I have the island right.
Yeah.
Let us then go to the picture here. Okay, oh, there's the Sewell Wright example. How nice. Diagram on page 15, which is essentially showing the difference between the ways the variables are treated in these two approaches. So here's a covariance matrix. We've seen a lot of these before. It's just semi-ellipse. Good. And here's the same covariance matrix. And here's the same covariance matrix. Now, to get the matrix inverse, we're looking for the variables, the linear combinations that correlate only with one of the individuals, the individual variables we started with. So if this is the regression, which it is, you remember, because it cuts the ellipse where this is vertical, essentially then you want to turn 90 degrees to get a linear combination here. It's 2x, this one is 2x minus y. That's uncorrelated with y and correlated, covariating one with x. And the interpretation, if you, let me go back to the numbers here. Do I go back a page or going forward a page? Where am I? I'm on the same page. I was going down the page. So here's a covariance matrix. The square root of 3 is just made to give it unit determinant. And here's the inverse. Take my word for it. Because you multiply these two together, you get the identity times 3. And this row of the inverse, 2 comma minus 1, corresponds to this direction on the plot, 2 times x minus y. It's the variable that has no covariance with y, with a vertical, and covariance 1, if you have to normalize it with x. And this is the other row of the inverse matrix. It's the variable, I think it's 2y minus x, that has zero covariance with x and the right covariance with y. So these two directions have been chosen to get rid of the correlation between these two. X and y are correlated, and the function of the matrix inverse is to create the patterns that correct each variable for all of its correlations with the other. And that's done variable by variable, row by row of the matrix. Here there are only two rows of the matrix. I would comment, this is not the explanation of matrix inverse that you get in any statistics textbook. It's consistent with them all, but they're trying to tell, they're doing inversion because they want to tell you how to do a regression. And this is instead saying, here is how you have to be talking if you do want to do regression. You have to be talking about the effect of each variable by itself, correcting for all of the other correlations. So here's the geometry of that picture. You basically take the regression lines and turn them 90 degrees. Matrix inversion is doing something totally different on the same covariance matrix. Here's an ellipse. We're finding its principal axes, its longest and its shortest diameters. These turn out to be defined as, you see it in the text, the linear combinations that correlate only with themselves. Over here, the matrix inverse, the rows, were the combinations that correlated with only one of the original variables and not with any of the others. This is the linear combination of the variables that correlates only with itself, not with the other axis. So this is reifying this linear combination. This is saying this is just 2x minus y is the correction of x for the regression on y. This isn't the correction of x for anything. This isn't anything about x. This is only about x and y together. It's the combination of x and y that has the highest variance and it predicts itself when you correlate it with everything. So this predicts x, this predicts y, those are separate. This predicts itself, and this predicts itself. They are cognate. Those are, by the way, the eigenvalues of the inverse matrix, which I mentioned to you. There's a connection between these, very deep. And it's that the eigenvectors, these principal dimensions of the inverse matrix, are the same as the eigenvectors of the matrix you started with, and the eigenvalues, their specific variances, are the inverses of those. And so the other way of computing the inverse matrix is to go from this matrix to the inverse matrix by a shear and see what happens to the original axes. If you shear this matrix into this matrix by putting uniform transformation on the picture,
what used to be vertical, sorry, what used to be horizontal, x, now goes this way, and what used to be vertical, y, now goes this way. And those are the same directions we had up here. Except I think I swapped x and y in the description. Oh, closer, forgive me. So to the mathematician, these are closely related techniques. To the biologist, they are as different as chalk and cheese, to use the old British phrase. They are making quite different assumptions about what was the reason for your measuring what you measured, and what was the reason for your asking what it was about the data you were asking, which, to get back to what I was saying in that bird example, makes it even more remarkable when they get the same answer about something. If two questions have the same answer, there has to be a relation between the questions, between evolution and between morphogenesis and survival, in the case of the birds. So, let's see, what else do we need from this section? There's some stuff on page 18 about how you do matrix algebra. There's an example on page 19 of how Sewell writes factor analysis, which we talked about in chapter 3 somewhere, actually can be produced by manipulation of the inverse matrix. This is checking Pearson's algebra. You don't want to do that. You just want to trust Pearson. If anybody wants this article from Pearson, it's 102 pages. I strongly urge you not to want it. It's on the web. But he did this by hand. He checked those matrix inversions.
There's a lot of a lot of the papers from that era have these, like, huge, dozens of pages of lengthy algebra of these people.
And everything cancels.
Well, they worked harder to get their results than we do now.
Yeah. Okay, here's, we had that chicken matrix from Sewell Wright. Here's the matrix inverse, and there's a simple transformation that's described in the text for how you get to that for possible factors that have two variables in them. Now, this is clever. It's called, what's it called? It's called the precision matrix, this computation. And it is a very specialized kind of computation that people have been using in quantitative psychology and sociology for a few decades, and which did not appear in the evolutionary literature until I published it in 2009 in a paper in systematic zoology that the reviewers had just never heard of the technique at all. But it's a standard one. If you're interested, you go through this precision matrix, and you go through looking at the big numbers, and here's a big number for the first two variables, which happen to be skull length and width, and that's saying there might be a skull factor. And here's a big number for arm length and width, wing length and width, there might be a wing factor, there might be a leg factor. So this is cheating, using matrix inversion formulas to get at an eigenanalysis optimal descriptor kind of thing. And this sort of thing works to the delight of statisticians, even when, as in this case, we're really mixing apples and oranges. We're asking the wrong technique to answer our question. We're saying, can you get me the factors of this chicken, the body factors of the chicken, the modules of this chicken, by a manipulation of the inverse matrix? And the answer is almost certainly not, unless you only measured factors twice, which is bad measurement, but it means there's a nice shortcut.
So I don't mean to slow you down here much.
I'm basically done with the first third.
So what you did is that this starts with the correlation matrix.
Right, which was printed someplace else in the book.
Of the data, just all the correlations.
Yeah. You saw the picture.
And you take its inverse.
And then do what it says in the text.
How do you get this one to write the
line? You hit that last matrix there. The instructions you can't read say, divide out every row and every column by the square root of the diagonal up there. And
so
then
you're
change
sort of
the sign
standardizing
of everything off
diagonal. Them so they
standardize
all
it by its diagonal. And then flip the sign of everything off diagonal. That's the rule for the precision matrix.
Okay.
And let me go up and you'll find it here. There we go.
And then the large values of that are clues as to
clues as to two variable factors. And this has been around in the literature of, it was Lewis Gutman, the psychologist of factor analysis, who published the first proof of this in 1936.
incomprehensible proof, take my word for it. It's a trivial proof once you've guessed it, but it only works for two variables. And here, the instructions are here on page 19. Divide each element of that inverse by the square root of its diagonals, and then to change the sign, and you get the partial correlation of each variable, each pair of variables holding all of the others constant. And that's the definition of a factor on two variables. I see everybody's writing. You don't have to. It's in the handout. It just sort of, it's an argument from practicality against the point I was making before.
Well, let's just say, whatever this is, it's not obvious.
It is obvious once someone shows it to you. The proof is this long.
Well, I'll accept that it has
it's
a proof.
Obvious.
But the question is, it wouldn't be the first thing I would think of.
No, and that's why Lewis Gutman would have gotten a Nobel Prize in psychometrics if it had existed. And God bless the man. He was one of my teachers. He must have mentioned this in the course of the lectures of his I listened to, because 30 years later, I said, that reminds me of something. Which is also the art of the statistician in just really refusing to let cosmic brain damage hit your memory. Okay, we're just about out of time, so I won't start section 4.2. This is a three-section chapter, so at this point we're about a third of a section behind. I will slow down. I won't speed up to cover it. I'll just delay some of the lectures. But let me go over the summary of what we just did, and then we can take questions. So we're just about to finish with section 1. Here's the bullet points. Somewhere. Hello. Okay, oops. So summary of section 1. The covariance we talked about makes the most sense to statisticians as the correlation times the product of the standard deviations. That's the way you write down the Gaussian model. That's the information matrix formalism. This was done by Carl Pearson about 1890s. This is the error variance of correlation. I'm copying from the matrix. These computations came from inverting a matrix, but it wasn't your data matrix. It was the information matrix, this strange structure of the second derivatives of the likelihood. So that was the statistician's matrix that you were inverting and then poking around in the numbers of. For this to be useful, those measures have to have separable meanings, and they do. The correlation is different from the standard deviation of the X, which is different from the standard deviation of Y. As a biologist, you're already talking about distinct entities in a way that makes sense for inversion. The other main application of matrix algebra is eigenanalysis that treats the rows and columns as samples of something and is trying to find linear combinations that satisfy extreme properties. The measured variables are not important by themselves. And either technique requires that your samples be homogeneous. If your samples are obviously heterogeneous, like this example here, you will always get the wrong answer. This is two populations, two separate covariance structures. Forgetting about that, I compute one pooled principal component analysis, the big ellipse in the middle. It's garbage. It is garbage to do these analyses over heterogeneous groups. Instead, the model must include the groups among its parameters. Must. That picture, if you didn't have those two little ellipses on the side, would lead to utterly incorrect findings. And that's my main error that I see in papers I get for review, is people have the middle ellipse there, the heavy line, and never checked for the big ellipses. And this is a fatal flaw in any analysis. Okay, Cooper, you had a question.
Hey.
Remember, I'm deaf. Either nope. Speak up or come close.
You covered it. Thank you.
Oh, how convenient. Okay. As I say, so this is one third of chapter 4. Tomorrow, when I'm back in 2 weeks, I'm sure I can get through section 2, which is the singularity decomposition, and a little bit of the Wisher distribution. And maybe we'll choose not to finish that, although there's one important formula to get back on or near schedule. Our next topic in morphometrics, dipping into this stuff when we need it, will be Procrustes coordinates and their uses and their principal components.
And the topic after that is thin plate splines and their formulas. And the topic after that, which is my last lecture, is finishing all the examples. So there's two more chunks of multivariate analysis that you have to have had waved in front of you. Then there's two more chunks of morphometric tool building. And then we finish all the examples.
My only worry is that the the Procrustes coordinates and the morphometric machinery will come very close to when they're supposed to be using it.
True. On the other hand, you have the readings in front of you. And even in London, I will get email. Feel free to read ahead. And chapter five is basically a whole short book of its own, trying to explain everything. And you've got, from my early handouts, you've got a printout of Procrustes analysis, Procrustes fits. Joe also has given you one. And principal components are built into R. So you have, either on the web or in the package itself, all the tools you need once you understand what's going on. And I always have faith in my own writing that you ought to be able to get that by reading ahead. Remember, these are all good examples. And none of the data is simulated. And I'll just go on teasing you about that. You need to measure some real salmon sometime.
And it might destroy my confidence in everything I do.
No, you're a theorist. There's no way that data could destroy your confidence.
Well, see, I work under the theorem, which is that
the world
follows
like
our models,
yeah.
And if it doesn't, so much the worse for the world.
Well, there's a wonderful quote from the history of statistics. All models are false, but some are useful. The question between Joe and me is, which are the useful models? It isn't the ones that get you tenure. It's the ones that teach you something stable about the world. I'm not sure you agree with that, because you're tenured.
I don't. Okay. Anyway, well, so are we done?
We're done for today. Cooper, you're in charge for Thursday. Paul Sampson, a nice guy, is coming on Tuesday. Joe's back on Thursday, and I'm back 2 weeks from today.